Blog Talk Radio.
Well, your dad's gum government, you sorry so-and-sos. You got your damn hands in every pocket of my clothes. Well, your dad's gum, dad's gum, dad's gum government. Uh-huh. Oh, don't you know? Oh, don't you love him sometimes? Uh-huh. Well, your dad's gum government, you better pay attention. You're setting up there like a fool's convention. Will you get dumb, get dumb, get dumb government? Uh-huh. Oh, don't you know? Oh, don't you love them sometimes? Uh-huh.
Welcome to Handling the Truth with the Rebel Madman and Tenacity. I am Terry Dodd, a.k.a. Tenacity, and I'm here with my co-host and our resident historian, Mike Getty. You can find his articles at therebelmadman.com. Mike, how you doing tonight?
Hey, doing great, Terry. Hope you are.
I am. Let's start this out right with a prayer so we don't run into technical difficulties.
Yes, sir.
You just can't imagine. You can't imagine how many times we've had technical difficulties on BTR when we forgot to say a prayer.
Well, let's get it done, buddy.
Here we go. Almighty Father in heaven, we're just so thankful for the ways that you bless us, and we see you at work out there in the world, and we also are watching your enemies. Father, we see them that are trying to destroy this entire world that you've created. They would love to reclaim it. They'd love to kill off a bunch of the people that you put on this earth. Father, we pray that you be with us tonight in this show and this program. We pray that you bless the work of Mike and myself, and pray that we've got some listening ears out there that will have a thirst to hear the truth, because that's what we're dealing with here. At least we believe we are, and we pray, Father, that everything we come out with and say and do is in your desire. And, Father, keep us on track. We need your spirit to guide us, and we know that all truth, you are the source, truly the source of all truth. And we're thankful for your Son and our Savior, Yahshua HaMashiach, because of the price he paid that covers us with his righteousness. Amen.
Amen and amen.
Well, Mike, here we are with series six, episode six of our series on swindled from the beginning. And I know you want to get back into talking about the anti-federalists, so I'm just going to give you the floor, because, man, when it comes to this history lesson, I love to just sit back and learn, because you certainly are one heck of a teacher, my brother.
Well, thank you so much for that, Terry. Yes, sir. Go ahead, sir.
No, go ahead.
Okay. One of the men that was considered to be an anti-federalist and kind of a unique set of circumstances surrounding him is that he is one of the few anti-federalists who actually attended the Constitutional Convention and was very instrumental in several of the disagreements that took place there, was very vocal about opposing slavery, was very vocal about what they're trying to do now with popular elections for the president as opposed to the Electoral College, and he saw through the faults of that. And but finally, when he was fighting against all the delegates, including the senators, being elected by representation, and we'll get into that, represented by population, that he was very much ridiculed. And, you know, we all were taught when we were young that these guys just got along famously, and they were all heavenly inspired, and they went there and they wrote this Constitution, and oh, how wonderful it is. In fact, by writing this new Constitution, those who signed the Constitution were violating the Constitution that was in effect at the time, which was the Articles of Confederation. So I don't know how you can credit someone for creating laws which they break to make the law. But anyway, let's get a little bit more into Luther Martin. And ironically, I was talking about Luther Martin on another talk show sometime back, and the host corrected me, and he said, you mean Martin Luther, don't you? And I said, no. Well, that shows how much that Luther Martin and a lot of our founders, as we call them, are not even known or heard of in today's world. But Luther Martin was born in New Jersey in 1748, and he graduated from what is now Princeton University with honors in 1766, and then promptly moved to Maryland to teach, study for the law, and to become a lawyer. Now, ironically, Luther Martin was very much an American and very much opposed to King George, because he used his position as a lawyer on numerous occasions to prosecute those we call loyalists or those who still supported King George. And Martin was also a strong, very strong advocate for the independence of the colonies. Quite a few interesting facets concerning Luther Martin's life, one of which was his animosity for Thomas Jefferson. And that was legal more than political. And his later legal defense of those whom Jefferson sought to prosecute for various reasons, including Federalist Supreme Court Justice Samuel Chase, who was also from Maryland. And, of course, when Jefferson sought to prosecute Aaron Burr, Luther Martin defended Aaron Burr. And that may have been because at the time, Luther Martin kind of had his eyes set on Aaron Burr's daughter. But anyway, Luther Martin was appointed to the position of Attorney General in Maryland in 1778, and he would hold that position for near almost three decades. As Attorney General, Martin would join the Baltimore Light Dragoons during the Revolutionary War, but he saw very limited action there. He was frequently called to perform his duties as Attorney General at the request of the governor. In late May of 1787, Luther Martin and four others from Maryland were commissioned as delegates to the Constitutional Convention of that year in Philadelphia. Because of the short notice and performance of his duties in Maryland as Attorney General, Martin arrived a few days late in Philadelphia, but became immediately concerned with the proceedings because of the rules that had been established before his arrival. And this is one of the great things that we have, is we have Martin Luther's actual words, Luther Martin's actual words addressing his concerns about these oaths and the proceedings as they were being carried out in Philadelphia. And so I will read those so that everyone can get an idea of exactly what was troubling Luther Martin. Quote, "Before I arrived, a number of rules had been adopted to regulate the proceedings of the convention, by one of which seven states might proceed to business, and consequently four states, the majority of that number, might eventually have agreed upon a system which was to affect the whole Union." Now, how many times have we been told that they agreed that if they only got seven states there, that they would make a government for the 13 colonies? And that was in their original agreement, and that was a total violation of Article 13 of the Articles of Confederation. Going back to Luther Martin's words, "By another, the doors were to be shut and the whole proceedings were to be kept completely secret. And so far did this rule extend that we were thereby prevented from corresponding with gentlemen in the different states upon the subjects under our discussion. A circumstance, sir, which I confess I greatly regretted. I had no idea that all of the wisdom, integrity, and virtue of Maryland or any other state would be centered solely in the convention in Philadelphia." As I stated before, Martin was a very strong advocate for states' rights, and he would be strongly opposed to the selection of members of Congress based alone on population. He believed this would tend to leave the powers of legislation in the states with the most people. And as I stated earlier, Terry, that's what we're looking at now with this popular election of the president. This was a most valid concern then, and it should be for us today, too. But that being said, the Congress of the United States has ignored the requirements listed in the Constitution of one representative for every 30,000 people. Today, we average one representative for every 776,000. So much for consent of the governed. If anyone believes that one member of the House of Representatives can represent the interest of 776,000 people, they've lost their minds. But during the course of the time that Luther Martin spent at the convention, he would author Article 6, Paragraph 2 of the new Constitution, which would be later become known as the Supremacy Clause. While fellow anti-federalist Samuel Bryan very adroitly points out in his essays that Paragraph 1 of Article 6 was written to cover the embezzlement of millions of dollars under the administration of Robert Morris as chief financial officer and Gouverneur Morris as his assistant in the government from 1781 to 1785, the second paragraph, or Clause 2, dealt with other matters. Later in the convention, Luther Martin would become disgusted with the proceedings at Philadelphia, and along with fellow Maryland delegate, John Francis Mercer, they just walked out in protest. And Terry, at this point, I think it's very important that we know that of the delegates that went to Philadelphia initially, 17 of those delegates became disgusted with the proceedings and left. And that is something that's just not talked about. Why did those people leave? Well, we know why four of them left. We know why Mercer and Luther Martin left, and we also know why that Robert Yates and John Lansing Jr. left. And when the finished product of the Constitution was signed and made public, Luther Martin became upset and concerned at how the wording and intent of Article 6, Clause 2 had been perverted to mean something much different than what he had intended when he wrote it. And you and I have talked about this, and we need to do a show on this sometime in the future, of how the Committee of Style altered what the delegates to the Constitutional Convention provided, how they even went in and added clauses and took other things out that they didn't like. And that it was really a story. And, of course, that was led by all Federalists, with Gouverneur Morris being the person who wielded the pen in these actions. And we also know that the Necessary and Proper Clause, one of the things I found that very ironic was when I was in the Library of Congress and I started looking through the various things to see what was happening, especially when I looked at each article of the Constitution and looked at the arguments surrounding each article, I found it very unusual that Article 1, Section 8, Clause 18, the Necessary and Proper Clause, there was never any debate. It was never mentioned during the convention itself, so it had to be added at the end, and I believe that was done by the Committee of Style. And the Necessary and Proper Clause is, as Patrick Henry said, would be the window through which all manners of evil shall pass. So, according to Luther Martin, what had he wanted to define with Article 6, Clause 2? And I think that's really, really critical today. Luther Martin's later writings and public speeches would reveal he believed that the trials in the Supreme Court should have a jury to rule on the proceedings of that court, and the absence of said jury gravely endangered freedom. Imagine that, Terry. What if today, when the Supreme Court heard a case, there was a jury of the people to decide? Would we not then have the consent of the governed, which we have now turned over to federal black robe bandits? I just wonder how many things would have come out different had we had a actual jury to hear Supreme Court cases. And in Article 6, Clause 2, that's what Luther Martin included. Why would the Federalists remove that? Martin.
Well, even today,
go ahead.
even today, Mike, they stack juries by making certain that anybody who is a free thought or a free thinker who really holds to any kind of common law whatsoever or natural law whatsoever, they just dismiss them from the jury. They kick them out of the jury. So the only way a free thinker or somebody who thinks for themselves can even get on a jury is to basically keep your mouth shut.
Oh, that's true. You can't tell them what you think. I actually was escorted from the courthouse one day when I was explaining to the prospective jurors who were sitting with me jury nullification. And so evidently my words about jury nullification got back to the judge, and I had law enforcement officers remove me from the courthouse. So, yes, you are exactly true. Martin would vigorously oppose ratification of the Constitution of 1787, both in print and with the spoken word. And as you and I were talking before we went on, the legislature of Maryland asked, and I wish all states would have done this, they asked their delegates to come back and stand before the legislature and explain to them what happened in Philadelphia. Now, many of them couldn't do it because, or if they honored their oath to keep quiet and not mention it for 50 years, which should trouble us all, that they wanted to hide what they were doing for 50 years. But anyway, Luther Martin hadn't taken that oath, and so he was very open to telling the legislature of Maryland what had gone on. And so he, during his presentation to the Maryland legislature, he had told them previously about Robert Yates and John Lansing Jr. leaving the convention in disgust. Pardon me. Told the members of the legislature about it. The members of the legislature asked some other delegates to the convention, and they had told them, no, it didn't happen. It didn't happen. Luther Martin's exaggerating. That didn't happen. So here is how Luther Martin addressed the Maryland legislature on that point. And he said, Speaker of the House of Delegates of Maryland, sir, I flatter myself the subject of this letter will be a sufficient, well, actually it was a letter, I'm sorry, not a speech, will be a sufficient apology for thus publicly addressing it to you and through you to the other members of the House of Delegates. It cannot have escaped you or your recollection that when called upon as the servant of a free state to render an account of those transactions in which I had a share in consequence of the trust reposed in me by that state, among other things, I informed them that sometime in July, the Honorable Mr. Yates and Mr. Lansing of New York left the convention, that they had uniformly opposed the system, and that I believe, despairing of getting a proper one brought forward or of rendering any real service, they returned no more. You cannot, sir, have forgotten, for the incident was too remarkable not to have made some impression. Upon my giving you this information, the zeal of one of my honorable colleagues in favor of a system which I thought it my duty to oppose impelled him to interrupt me, and in a manner which I am confident his zeal alone prevented him from being convinced was not the most delicate, to insinuate pretty strongly that the statement which I had given of the conduct of those gentlemen and their motives for not returning was not candid. Those honorable members have officially given information on this subject by a joint letter to His Excellency Governor Clinton of New York. Indulge me, sir, in giving an extract from it, that it may stand contrasted in the same page with the information I gave, and may convict me of the want of candor of which I was charged, if the charge was just. If it will not do that, then let it silence my accusers. What a great way of saying, they accuse me of lying, now let them prove it. So here is what he quoted from Yates and Lansing. Thus circumstanced under these impressions, to have hesitated would have been to be culpable. We therefore gave the principles of the Constitution, which has received the sanction of a majority of the convention, our decided and unreserved dissent. We were not present at the completion of the new Constitution, but before we left the convention, its principles were so well established as to convince us that no alteration was to be expected to conform to our ideas of expediency and safety. A persuasion that our further attendance would be fruitless and unavailing rendered us less solicitous to return. Then Martin says, "These, sir, are their words. On this I shall make no comment. I wish not to wound the feelings of any person. I only wish to convince. I have the honor to remain, with the utmost respect, your very obedient servant, Luther Martin." Luther Martin, Terry, also spoke against the claiming the Articles of Confederation must be replaced by a new constitution because the Articles lacked the necessary energy, which was the huge argument among the Federalists. This constitution doesn't have enough energy. I think we see the energy our constitution has today. Martin would write eloquently of his objections using an allegory of Aesop, in which was drawn the image of the people being frogs, and those frogs trading their known log for an unknown crane, which would devour them all. And I think this is just beautiful the way he did it, and I will read that as well. And I quote, "There are also persons who pretend that your situation is at present so bad that it cannot be worse, and urge that as an argument why we should embrace any remedy proposed, however desperate it may appear. Thus do the poor erring children of mortality, suffering under the presence of real or imaginary evils, have recourse to a pistol or halter for relief, and rashly launch into the untried regions of eternity, nor wake from this delusion until they wake in endless woe. Should the citizens of America, in a fit of desperation, be induced to commit this fatal act of political suicide, to which by such arguments they are stimulated, one day will come when, laboring under more than Egyptian bondage, compelled to finish their quota of brick, though destitute of straw and of mortar, galled with your chains and worn down with your oppression, you will, by sad experience, be convinced, when that conviction shall be too late, there is a difference in evils, and that the buzzing of gnats is more supportable than the sting of a serpent. From the wisdom of antiquity, we might obtain excellent instruction if we were not too proud to profit by it." Pardon me. Aesop has furnished us with a history of a nation of frogs, between which and our own there is a striking resemblance. Whether the catastrophe be the same rests with ourselves. Jupiter, out of pure good nature, wished to do them as little injury as possible on being asked for a king, had thrown down into their pond a log to rule over them, under whose government, had they been wise enough to know their own interest and to pursue it, they might to this day have remained happy and prosperous. Terrified with the noise and frightened by the violent undulations of the water, they for some time kept an awful distance and regarded their monarch with reverence. But the first impression being in some measure worn off and perceiving him to be of a tame and peaceable disposition, they approached him with familiarity and soon entertained for him the utmost contempt. In a little time were seen the leaders of the frogs croaking to their respective circles on the weakness and feebleness of the government at home and of its want of dignity and respect abroad, till the sentiment being caught by their auditors, the whole pond resounded with, "O Jupiter, good Jupiter, hear our prayers. Take away from us this vile log, and give us a ruler who shall know how to support the dignity and splendor of government. Give us any government you please, only let it be energetic and efficient." The Thunderer, in his wrath, sent them a crane. With what delight did they gaze on their monarch as he came majestically floating on the wings of the wind. They admired his uncommon shape. It was such as they have never seen before. His deformities were in their eyes the greatest of beauties, and they were heard like Aristides to declare that, were they on the verge of eternity, they would not wish a single alteration in his form. His monstrous beak, his long neck, and his enormous poke, even those, the future means of their destruction, were subjects of their warm approbation. He took possession of his new dominions and instantly began to swallow down his subjects, and it is said that those who had been the warmest zealots for crane administration fared no better than the rest. as I'm reading this, and I hate to just read stuff to people, but as I'm reading this, I'm seeing the very image of what we have in this country today. We have believed that this Constitution would protect us. And the Constitution was designed with all of these loopholes to make sure it didn't. And we are now the frogs begging this. And also, as I thought of this, Terry, I thought of one Samuel chapter 8. Give us a king. And it just sticks in my mind. The poor wretches were now, and I'm continuing, were now much more dissatisfied than before, and with all possible humility applied to Jupiter again for his aid, but in vain. He dismissed them with this reproof, that the evil of which they complained they had foolishly brought upon themselves, and that they had no other remedy now but to submit with patience. What do we have to do right now, Terry, with this mess that's going on in this country, but to submit with patience? Thus forsaken by the God and left to the mercy of the crane, cruelty by flight, but pursuing them to every place of retreat and thrusting his long neck through the water to the bottom, he drew them out with his beak from their most secret hiding places and served them up as a regale for his ravenous appetite. The present federal government is, my fellow citizens, the log of the fable. The crane is the system now offered to your acceptance. I wish you not to remain under the government of the one, nor to become subjected to the tyranny of the other. If either of these events take place, it must arise from your being greatly deficient to yourselves, from your being like the nation of frogs, a discontented, variable race, weary of liberty and fond of change. At the same time, I have no hesitation in declaring that if the one or the other must be our fate, I think the harmless, inoffensive, though contemptible log infinitely to be preferred to the powerful, the efficient, but all-devouring crane. Thoughts, Terry?
Mike? Yeah.
Yes, sir.
I want to come back to this word energetic. And I also want to come back to this 50-year of silence pledge that was taken. Let's look at this pledge first. What the heck were these men thinking? I mean, if you walked into a convention like that and the first thing they said was, we want you to take an oath that you're not going to talk about any of this for 50 years, well, how would you react to that?
Well, I'm afraid I would have left at that point, Terry. But
I'm not sure I would have left, but I sure wouldn't have taken the oath.
Well, no, and that is one thing that Luther Martin didn't do because he got there late.
Well, yeah, that was a very fortunate occurrence, and I would have wished I got there late too, but not really, because I would like to have been there when they tried that stuff, because I would have told them exactly what I thought about it and said there's no way. They would have probably run me off. They might have run me off, but I'm not sure I would have just left, because at that point I'd be feeling like somebody needed to watch these crooks and see what they're doing. But I can't imagine how all of those men, they got that many of them to take that oath. The word energetic strikes me as willfully dishonest. Can you put some honest words on what that really meant, what they were really saying, in an honest term that a guy that with a fourth grade education could understand exactly what it was they were saying when they said the articles were not sufficiently energetic?
Well, Terry, I think it was very simple in knowing the rest of the history and knowing how many times these Federalists in Congress under the Articles of Confederation had tried time after time after time to set up taxation schemes to rob the people. And that was their frustration. That was their level of frustration. That's why they had the Annapolis Convention. That's why Alexander Hamilton went to the New York legislature, is because they could not produce their grand schemes and enrich themselves and their fellow Federalists with a system that didn't allow to the point to where they could demand that the people pay whatever they said they wanted and how much money they wanted. And I think that is absolutely shown in the first power given to Congress under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1, which gave the Congress an unlimited amount of taxation and unlimited methods. They could tax you on anything for any purpose, anything they wanted to do. And so I think with the very first power given to Congress, they showed what they were after. And their problems were is they were not able to, like in today's world, we look at how so many people get into government to use government to feather their own nest and to make themselves rich. The Art of Federation didn't allow that. And so they couldn't come out and say, we need a government that's going to allow us to take your money. They had to camouflage that with a word that they thought the public might fall for, and unfortunately they did. But they said, we need a government of more energy. And Alexander Hamilton even told him the truth on a couple of occasions. He said, we need a form of government that will allow us to become an empire, a great empire. And Patrick Henry took that apart in the Virginia Ratification Convention about being an empire. But unfortunately, that enough people didn't hear that either. But I believe, Terry, that what they did was they actually went to the state legislatures where they knew they had a chance. And I believe the reason that people eagerly, I probably shouldn't use the word eagerly, I wasn't there, I don't know. But the reason that they accepted without question this 50 years of silence through the connections of Washington, Madison, John Jay, Alexander Hamilton, throughout their connections with other government officials, they had pretty well ensured, or at least they hoped they had ensured, that the only people who would show up in Philadelphia would be people who agreed with their position. And I'm looking for it now because I once wrote an article on who the delegates to the convention actually were. And that, I think, was quite enlightening, especially when you look, number one, look at Pennsylvania. You could send up to 8 delegates to the Constitutional Convention. Some states didn't do that. New York sent only 3. Pardon me. But you had 8 delegates from the state of Pennsylvania, and they were all 8 from Philadelphia. How in the world could you say that the people in western Pennsylvania, how could you say that they had any representation whatsoever? All 8 were merchants or people in, or lawyers or judges from Philadelphia. Now,
Let's park here for a second. I think people who listen to this need to grasp just how sinister this situation was. You've disclosed the fact that they were basically thieves wanting to live off of the sweat of other men's brow. They were basically like banksters, wealthy elitists that, you know, were looking for a way to enrich themselves. But that's not all. That's not the worst of what I see and what you're telling me. They were 11 years from the Revolution. How many men died in the Revolutionary War?
I'm not sure of the exact number.
I'll take a guesstimate.
Okay.
The point is, the number doesn't really matter. We know that a lot of men lost their lives in the Revolutionary War. What were they fighting for?
They were fighting for
freedom
and liberty.
What was the principal cause? They were fighting for freedom and liberty, but what really fueled it, you know, the Tea Party thing, the whole, was it they were pissed off about how much tax they were having to pay.
Exactly.
They were being ripped off by taxation, and it was only about 12%, as I recall. 12% of the revenues were being taxed.
It was more in the range of 6%.
Compare that to today. But my point is this: here they are, 11 years from the time that all of those men fought and died for exactly what they are now putting in place, and even more extreme than what the revolution was fought for and those men died for. What did that say about what these men thought of those men who laid their lives down for the freedom of this federation?
Well, Terry, the firebrands, the real firebrands of independence, who really got this, who lit the fuse to what became the Revolutionary War, were not even at the convention, and I don't think that the Federalists actually wanted them at the convention, because, Samuel Adams wasn't there. Patrick Henry was there. Of course, he was invited, but he said that he smelled a rat leaning toward a monarchy in Pennsylvania, so he didn't go. And rightfully so, but man, if I can only imagine what that would have been like if Luther Martin would have had Patrick Henry there to speak with him against these proposals, because was just absolutely incredible what Luther Martin went through. I mean, he was ridiculed. They shouted him down when he was trying to speak. I mean, it's in the records, but we're never taught this. So why weren't we? So,
well, for the same reason they didn't want to talk about it openly for 50 years.
Well, the key, and I firmly believe this, the key to this whole thing was George Washington. Because they had tried to get their commercial interests together in the Annapolis Convention from where it was named, in the previous year. But they couldn't even get Maryland to show up, and they had the convention in their state. So without Washington, all of this would have gone down the drain. Washington initially told them over and over again he didn't want to go. And then finally his fellow generals and James Madison and Alexander Hamilton finally worked their magic and finally convinced him to go. So that to me was the key, Washington. And Washington, his generals, especially Knox and a couple of others, had written to him, and they were terribly, and here again, Terry, you made a great analogy. They were very upset about Shays Rebellion. Very, very, very upset about Shays Rebellion. Many people will tell you that Shays Rebellion is what led to the Constitution, because they thought, and the Federalists used this, saying the whole country's about to break out in insurrection. But Shays Rebellion was just two of the Boston Tea Party and Concord and the other battles, and Lexington Green. Daniel Shays, the difference in their revolution was the fact that they were revolting against their own government here in the States instead of King George. That was the only difference. And they were rejecting taxation. They didn't want the taxation that had been brought about in 1780 in their Constitution. They didn't like the fact that here these men, the majority of them in western Pennsylvania, western other places, had gone off to fight in this war, and then they were paid in scrip, and then they were told that they were going to have to come up with taxes to pay off the scrip, which was the money coming to them. No wonder they revolted. So, yes, this was a tax scheme. The entire Constitution was a tax scheme. We have to have the ability to coerce. Washington put that in his record, in his letter, and so did James Madison. We must have a government that gives us the ability to coerce. And Gouverneur Morris said at the convention, well, you know, if we can't convince them with anything else, we'll use the bayonet. I mean, it's really simple for people who would really delve into the history of this era, exactly what happened. The thing was those Federalists who met in Philadelphia in 1787 wanted a monarchy. Alexander Hamilton pitched for a monarchy. And ironically, James Madison made the statement after Hamilton made that pitch for a complete monarchy. James Madison said, and it's record, it's in the National Archives, he made the statement, he said, well, it looks like Alexander Hamilton let the cat out of the bag. So what does that mean to you, Terry, when Hamilton says he wants a monarchy and Madison then says, well, he went too far, I think he let the cat out of the bag. How do you take that?
Well, I take it that it was one of the few honest statements Madison probably ever made.
Well,
he was basically saying that's what we were scheming to do, but you're not supposed to say it. That's what it means to me.
Well, you know, the way they were going to do this was they were going to rule the country basically with three states. And the scheme that they went there with, they had planned to basically rule the country with just three states. Because if they elected not only the House of Representatives, they also wanted to elect the senators. They wanted the senators to be there by population. So Virginia would have had five senators, I think it was. To me, that tells me a lot, you know, of how they actually wanted to go about
this. So which three states?
The states that would have basically controlled the country would have been Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Massachusetts. Because I think, if I remember correctly, I could stand corrected on this. Virginia would have five senators. Massachusetts and Pennsylvania would have had four, and the rest of the states would have either, based on population, would have either had two senators or one. That was the original proposition.
Senators?
Yes, because they wanted the senators elected by population as well as the members of House of Representatives.
Well, they eventually got it within each state with the 17th Amendment, but they still limited it to just two per state.
Right.
And with the 17th Amendment, it made it so they were basically career politicians.
Okay, well, let's look at what Luther Martin outlined, how Virginia sought to gain the most influence along with Pennsylvania and Massachusetts in a plan wherein the states with the most population would achieve controlling interest in the government. And here's a comment that I made. Ironically, we are seeing the exact same dynamic in the country today with the move by various states to elect the president by popular vote. Okay, here's what Luther Martin had to say. Now, think about this, Terry. The object of Virginia and the two other large states is to increase their power and influence over the others did not escape observation. The subject, however, was discussed with great coolness in the committee of the whole House, for the convention had resolved itself, pardon me, into a committee of the whole to deliberate upon the propositions delivered in by the honorable member from Virginia. What he's saying here is this was the Virginia plan that was written by James Madison, but produced at the convention by Edmund Randolph. Now there was a purpose to even this. Madison was 5'6". He was very sickly looking. He had a real squeaky voice. And he knew that if he tried to make this proposition, it wouldn't sound to the delegation. So he gave it to Edmund Randolph, who was 6'4", with a deep baritone voice. I mean, they even went to this much detail to get their theory across. And he says, hopes were formed that the farther we proceeded in the examination of the resolutions, the better the House might be satisfied on the impropriety of adopting them, and that they would finally be rejected by a majority of the committee. If, on the contrary, a majority should report in their favor, it was considered that it would not preclude the members from bringing forward and submitting any other system to the consideration of the convention, and accordingly, while those resolves were the subject of discussion in the Committee of the Whole House, a number of the members who disapproved them were preparing another system. Now listen, these are the machinations that were going on at this time, such as they thought more conducive to the happiness and welfare of the states. The propositions originally submitted to the convention, having been debated and undergone a variety of alterations in the course of our proceedings, the Committee of the Whole House, pardon me, by a small majority, agreed to a report, which I am happy, sir, to have in my power to lay before you. It was as follows. Now, here is what they said. And it said, here was my comment. It is easy to discern from the description above the subterfuge that was taking place in the convention, even aside from the obvious intentions of leaving the restrictions of the Articles of Confederation in the heat and the dust of Philadelphia, which is exactly what they did. Now let us take a look at the proposals for the new government, which Martin spoke of in the previous comment. Now here was their proposition. One, resolve that it is the opinion of this committee that a national government ought to be established, consisting of a supreme legislature, a supreme judiciary, and a supreme executive. That's a monarchy. Number two, that the legislative ought to consist of two branches, that the members of the first branch or the national legislature ought to be elected by the people of the several states for the term of 3 years to receive fixed stipends by which they may be compensated for the devotion of their time to public service, to be paid out of the national treasury, to be ineligible to any office established by a particular state or under the authority of the United States, blah, blah, blah. That the members of the second branch of the legislature ought to be chosen by the individual legislature. Now, that was what they ended up with. Now, that's how they, what ended up being passed. So, but here is what they did. Number seven, it says that the right of suffrage in the first branch of the national legislature, or the House, ought not to be according to the rule established in the Articles of Confederation, but according to some equitable rate of representation, namely in proportion to the whole number of white and other free citizens and inhabitants of every age, sex, and condition, including those bound to a servitude for a term of years, and three-fifths of all other persons not comprehended in the foregoing description, except Indians who are not paying taxes in each state. Now, here's number eight. That the right of suffrage in the second branch of the national legislature, or the Senate, ought to be according to the rule established in the first. They wanted both houses of Congress to be elected by the population. There, anyway, these resolves are all there. I have all of those that I got from the Library of Congress. And so then I think it's of interest here. So what were Luther Martin's thoughts on these proposals, which were sanctioned by the majority of delegates present in that committee? Let us not forget that a vast majority of delegates present at this convention were Federalists and Nationalists from the very beginning, which I alluded to earlier. They wanted to stack this convention. And a great number believed that they would be participating in the government which they were in Philadelphia to create. And that is true, because as I mentioned before, when you got to, you had a Federalist as president, you had a Federalist appoint an entire Federalist Supreme Court, and then you had both branches of the legislature. The Senate was 10-1 Federalist, and the House of Representatives was 5-1. So they created a government that they would run. Now, who in the world today would allow a bunch of lawyers, judges, and businessmen like Bloomberg and Saul Adelson and several other people? Would you want Bezos and what's his name with Facebook and these millionaires, Bloomberg, would you want them to collect a few judges and lawyers and go create a new constitution for this country? That's what happened in 1787.
Yep.
So here I found it. And here was what. It was proposed that the Senate should consist of 28 members formed on the following scale. Virginia would have 5. Pennsylvania and Massachusetts would each have 4. South Carolina, North Carolina, Maryland, New York, and Connecticut would have 2. And New Hampshire, Rhode Island, and New Jersey, Delaware, and Georgia would have 1 senator. Upon this plan, the 3 large states, Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Massachusetts, would have 13 senators out of 28, almost one half of the whole number. 15 senators were to be a quorum to proceed to business. Those 3 states would therefore have 13 of that 15. Having this inequality in each branch of the legislature, it must be evident, sir, that they would make what laws they pleased, however disagreeable or injurious to the other states, and that they would always prevent the other states from making any laws, however necessary and proper, if not agreeable to the views of those 3 states. So what are your thoughts on that, Terry?
Well, we obviously can see now clearly how we've arrived with what we've got today of an out-of-control federal government that has been infiltrated and expanded. I mean, it's grown like a fungus, if you will. You know, once it got started, it just kept growing and growing and growing, totally out of control. You just have to wonder if Luther Martin and Patrick Henry and the other anti-federalists had been listened to, if their voices had been heard and followed and respected and not written out of history, what would things look like today in the United States if their concerns, if their warnings, if their prophecies had been adhered to?
Well, Terry, I think an interesting way to phrase that, and that is a great question, absolutely a great question. What would the country look like today under the Articles of Confederation? Number one, we wouldn't have a president. Why do we need a president?
Well, what were the presidents before Washington, the 1 year?
Well,
they served for 1 year. What was their capacity?
Well, they were there as presidents. They were elected, like you said, for 1 year. But here is the greatest thing that I think about this so many times. And that is, we don't even know who they were. And that's a good thing. Because if we would have known who they were, it would be like the ones we know today. And the ones we know today are the ones who perverted their powers. We remember, who are the ones we think about today? Most Americans today, in almost all polls, will tell you the 2 greatest presidents in American history were Abraham Lincoln and FDR, both of whom were so far left socialists, it's unreal. They were Marxist socialists. Those 2, and America thinks those were our 2 greatest presidents. I mean, if you go back to his speeches, his 1 term in the Congress, and here was the thing I never could understand. Abraham Lincoln did 1 term in Congress and couldn't get reelected to the Congress. The people didn't want him after one stint as a member of Congress. And if you go back and read his speeches as a member of Congress, no one attacked capitalism and the free market more as a congressman possibly than the people we have now, like Pelosi and Schumer and others. read his speeches, read Abraham Lincoln's speeches when he was in Congress. It's scary. He was an abject socialist. And then when you look at what he did with his army and with his administration, I mean, he took one of Karl Marx's best friends and made him Assistant Secretary of War, Charles A. Dana. And he had at least four generals in the Union Army who weren't even U.S. citizens, who were socialists out of Europe. And yet we consider this, we've got a big marble statue for the monument for this man in Washington, D.C. Why? Perverted history has destroyed us, Terry.
Well, it's covered up so much. I mean, we look for transparency, and it almost was worse back then because the people didn't have access to the information that we have today.
Well, but the access to most of it's perverted. I mean, what they're teaching in schools is perverted history at all levels. They're not teaching
what's fed to the people is perverted, but they didn't even have access to the non-perverted, as much non-perverted information as we have today. They were given,
there, but nobody wants to look.
They found out what did they find out a week later when something happened? I mean, kind of too late to do anything about it. But I just didn't have that kind of a vision of the past. I didn't recognize that it was just as perverted then as it is now. I mean, why did Burr take on Hamilton in a duel? Was Hamilton the Jeffrey Epstein of the day?
Well, Hamilton was very upset with Burr because Burr had challenged Philip Schuyler, that was Hamilton's father-in-law, had challenged him for governor of New York. That made Hamilton very upset, and Hamilton was also, he also believed that Burr was the person who let the cat out of the bag or told the secret about Hamilton having an affair with his best friend's wife. And so those were two things that really led Hamilton to really hate Burr.
So Hamilton was an adulterer.
Oh, yes, admitted. He the story is, and it is, I'm not sure how you corroborate the story as such, but I read that when the story got out about him having an affair with his best friend's wife, that he offered his best friend a large amount of money on the provision to make things right, offered him a large amount of money, but only if he would allow the affair to continue.
Oh, was it like $10,000 or something like that? I heard.
That
he offered him at that?
I heard it was $10,000.
Well, how much is that worth today?
Oh my, that'd be a small fortune today for sure. So go ahead, my friend. Any other thoughts?
You know, I'm looking at, people want to do a constitutional convention or claim that we need a balanced budget amendment. Would we even be thinking about that sort of thing if the word expressly, just that one word, had been left in the 10th Amendment that was taken out of?
Yes, expressly was taken out of the 10th Amendment, Thomas Tudor Tucker kept trying to reinsert it, and Madison kept saying, no, we can't hold the government strictly to a set of rules, was basically what he said.
How many bureaucracies exist within the federal government today? Do we even have a clue, or has anybody bothered to count that?
Say again that question, Terry. I'm sorry. Background noise.
Bureaucracies. How many does anybody know? I mean, have you ever heard anybody even try to estimate how many bureaucracies exist within our federal government today?
Oh, my goodness. That's incredible, Terry.
I mean, Obama alone created over 110, or it might have been 120, bureaucracies during his term. So, I mean, if he created that many, how many were there before? I mean, there's got to be thousands of bureaucracies that have been created. And if they, and we're all paying for that. Every time they create a bureaucracy, it increases the cost of this government and expands the control of this government. If that word, just that one word expressly, had been left in there, how many of those bureaucracies would not have been able to be created?
Oh, my. 98% of them.
I'm just trying to get our listeners to recognize that even changing just one word can make that kind of big effect. And you've got these attorneys who were bankster controlled, obviously. You know, just changing little words that some people complained about, but most of them just went along with. And just one word would make a monstrously huge difference in what we're facing today.
Absolutely. And then when we get into this study of the Committee of Style and Gouverneur Morris, and there was even a huge deal when he changed a semicolon to a comma, which completely changed the essence. So just one little grammar, one little point of punctuation changed the meaning, and he knew what he was doing. He was, if you want to call someone a wordsmith, and this is well documented, the man that was a wordsmith was Gouverneur Morris during the founding era. Time when we get into covering that part of Gouverneur Morris and his eloquence and wording. And here's another thing. When you go back, you can make little studies of the Constitutional Convention. Who spoke at the Constitution more than anyone else? Who made the most motions at the Constitutional Convention? Gouverneur Morris. And Gouverneur Morris was a delegate from Pennsylvania, but he lived in New York. Figure that one out.
How did that happen?
The legislature of the state of Pennsylvania, which was heavily controlled by the people in Philadelphia, picked Gouverneur Morris to be a delegate from Pennsylvania because he knew he was not going to be picked by Governor Clinton in New York. Goes back to my previous comment, Terry, that they made sure that they had the right people in Philadelphia, at least a majority of the right people.
And that would be the exact same case today if they had another constitutional convention.
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt.
So my assumption that the Congress would probably look to the governors to appoint delegates, because the U.S. Congress is who would be calling and therefore controlling the delegate process. I speculated that they would turn to the governors for a nominating committee, and you're telling me that that's exactly what they did in 1787.
Oh, exactly true, Terry, but we, you know, they rely on the public pool system and their socialist professors in college to make sure that not enough people who have been thoroughly indoctrinated have any clue about this.
It doesn't get any better. The more we learn, it doesn't get any better about what went on. I mean, it's
no.
Is there anything that you can point to in what you've researched and learned that you can say was patriotic or socially, you know, did anything go on at this time that other than the people who spoke out against it and were shouted down? What good came out of this thing? Anything?
Well, actually, Terry, I think two things are very striking to me. And number one was that in late June, when it was very hot and they're very oppressive inside that building, and there are several documents to that effect, and things were just really heated in discussion as well as in temperature, and things were not going very well, is when Benjamin Franklin made his motion to begin every session with prayer. And he got a second, but the discussion went south, and there never was a vote. And Benjamin Franklin, in his biography, said that he thought that there were no more than three or four delegates in that entire convention who wanted prayer. And to me, that is so telling. That of all people, the delegate who had to bring up the thought that we may need prayer was Benjamin Franklin. And then to attack with Article 6, Clause 3, to say, we need to get rid of all oaths to the Christian faith in the states as well as the federal government. And Article 6, Clause 3 did that. And we make it sound great today, all the separation between church and state. That wasn't what the Federalists wanted. The Federalists didn't want people coming to the creating, having taken a sacred oath to the Christian faith. Because the majority of the people in Pennsylvania were either deist or Unitarians. That's documented. And the fact that the Constitution was the first American document not to mention the Creator as the sovereign is most telling as well.
We actually have someone with their hand up, and I don't know if you want to take a call. It looks like it's coming out of maybe New York.
Sure.
Let me know if you want to.
Yeah, let's do it.
Before I give them a live mic, I want to make it clear that we're not going to turn the show over to someone to bloviate. If you've got a question for Mike or myself, I'm going to give you an open mic to ask a question. If you have a very, very brief comment about something we've talked about, that would be good. But we're not looking for someone to come on and to bloviate. So area code 332, you have a live mic. What's your name?
Yeah, just a quick question. Can you take a steamy shit on me, just like right on my chest, just a fat, steamy shit?
Mike, did you understand that?
I did not.
Well, the caller dropped. I didn't cut him off. He just dropped. So there you go.
I have no clue.
So we got about 10 minutes left here. Mike, how do you want to conclude this?
Oh, well. You know, Terry, I think so many times of Lysander Spooner when it comes to the Constitution. He said this in the 1850s, I think it was. when he said the Constitution was either designed to allow these things to happen or it was powerless to prevent it. Now, as we look at the turmoil that's in this country today, and I believe that one of the things that has led us to this problem with those we call law enforcement had came out of the Supreme Court. I believe we can trace a lot of maladies in this country back to the Black Robe Bandits. And that is very simply in the 1960s, I think it was 67, when they first came up with this idea of implied immunity. So if you're a cop and you're out here as a government employee and you're doing whatever you're doing and you kill somebody, you're not responsible because that was your job. And then they started blaming it on the training. In Tucson, Arizona, when all those cops went rushing in on the gentleman down there who had just gotten off a night shift job and went running into his house, which happened to be the wrong house. They were looking for his uncle, not him. And they go running into his house. He is awakened by the screaming of his wife and kids, comes running out of his bedroom with his AR in his hand and gets shot 63 times. The police were in the wrong house. This wasn't a black guy either. The police were in the wrong house. They shot a man. The prosecutor wouldn't prosecute. He said, oh, they were just following their training. Well, if you're following your training and you kill innocent people, there's something wrong with your training. And then, of course, the city or the county had to offer this man's family $3.8 million, or at least that's what they settled for, and they get $3.8 million, which the police do not pay, the taxpayers pay. So we've got a problem with overzealous law enforcement in this country. I had a friend in Colorado who ran for sheriff back in 2016, and he said something to us that really bothered us because he had been a policeman in San Bernardino, California, the sheriff's department in San Bernardino, California for 20-some years. He moved to Colorado, opened a business. We talked him into running for sheriff. We thought he'd make a good sheriff, but he had to go back to the police academy. And after like 3 weeks into the police academy, he told us, he said, look, guys, they're not training cops there. They're training assassins. Well, what are we seeing today? What are we seeing happen? Go to Albuquerque, New Mexico. Look at the mess they had down there, all the people the police were shooting, including a homeless man with a pocket knife. Why? Why are these things happening? And you can take it right back to the Supreme Court with their decision to implied immunity. If you tell somebody, hey, shoot anybody you want to, you have a license to kill. You're James Bond. And it's called implied immunity. How can you expect anything good to come out of that? And then the Supreme Court rules on five separate occasions that the police have no obligation to protect you. Well, then why are they there? Oh, revenue collectors. So most of the problems that we see today, Terry, emanated, saw their birth in our government. You know, human life means nothing anymore, Roe v. Wade. Go ahead and take it from there, Terry.
Wow. I don't want to bloviate either. I've been on my soapbox a couple of times today. We're being lied to in so many ways, starting in the classroom and in history classes and in the textbooks, and it's rather startling when you start looking at the truth and bringing out the truth of what really went on, because we just haven't been fed that. We haven't been told that, so it's startling. In some ways, it's almost depressing. I mean, if I didn't know who was the final victor was, if I didn't have a relationship with our Creator and His Son, whose hand actually, if it wasn't for that, I don't know where I'd be right now. Where in my head and my thoughts. you look around and it's pretty scary because everything we're being told about this COVID thing, about this George Floyd, if you know, if that's what you want to call him, it's my understanding that the real George Floyd's attorney, who was actually his guardian ad litem when he was homeless years ago, was present at his funeral three years ago. It's just, we've got another hand up. You want to give it another try?
Sure.
We've only got probably 5 minutes to go here. But again, caller, I'm going to give you a live mic, but we're looking for your question for Mike or me. We're not looking for you to take a lot of time to bloviate or make your point. So area code 818, you have a live mic. What's your name?
All right, here's the big question. Are you a fan of anal sex?
Well, I'll tell you what, we've got some wonderful people tonight, Terry.
Well, I guess we don't need to discuss that. I just simply cut his mic off and he disappeared. It's one problem with this type of a show where you've got a live switchboard. I always, before when we were working with Red on the Walls in Our Mind show, we always had a producer that would screen them, so they kind of had an idea of what was going on. But I don't have an opportunity here running the switchboard and hosting the show too. So it really does help to have someone screen those calls for you.
Oh, well, you know, the one
well,
thing that
wrap,
I know is
wrap
two,
it up here for this week. Mike?
Well, the two we've had tonight definitely their IQs are somewhere below room temperature. Terry, I just as I mentioned to you before we actually went on air, I would really, and I think it would be huge in America if they actually did a movie on the truth of the founding of this country. On how these things actually happened, about the interactions, the people who really stood together, the people who didn't like each other, why they didn't like each other. If they put all these things together, and you know, I think Luther Martin and Thomas Jefferson are a great combination. And you wonder why Thomas Jefferson didn't get along with Luther Martin, and he didn't get along with Patrick Henry. When in many cases their beliefs were very, very close. So, yeah, there were different personalities, and, you know, you throw in your Aaron Burr and you throw in a few others, it gets quite interesting.
Well, you know, there's only one thing stopping us from doing that.
Money.
We need a few million dollars. We could probably pull off a pretty good movie for $3 or $4 million. So if anybody's listening and you'd like to contribute to that cause, we'd love to hear from you. I'm Terry Dodd in Colorado, pretty easy to find. This is Mike Getty. We're not going to talk about where he's at the moment. But, you know, you could call in on this show on a Thursday night, and I'll give you a live mic and we can exchange some personal information within a private chat and figure out how to get that funded, because I think it's a worthy cause. I really do. I think it would be an incredible – first of all, it would be interesting. It would really make a good movie. I think it would be an enjoyable and profitable movie. But on top of that, it could be done in such a way that it would be a great education tool. And I talked with the guy I told you that produced the War of 1812 that won
right.
The awards on the History Channel. And I talked with him once before about doing some 7-minute videos in a way that could be done as a long play movie, but could be broken up into 6 or 7 minute snippets, if you will, or vignettes or whatever you want to call them, so that you could use shorter educational kind of stuff out of it. I think it could be done really effectively, and he did too. He agreed with me, and he's an award-winning filmmaker. So let's explore that. Maybe we should talk to some deep pocket people and see if we could get that funded. I really believe it would be profitable. It would be a good investment. Do you?
Oh, I do. I really think, and I think it would be great for the country, for people to see that these people were actually human beings. They are not demigods. These were people who had their faults. And I love Thomas Jefferson and the fact that he admitted his. And the one thing, Luther Martin was so well-liked in American history that no one knows where his grave is because they paved over it in New York to make sure nobody knew where his grave was. So that shows you how much Luther Martin was thought of in American history.
Well, and that's pretty true of quite a few of the reformers from back in the 16th century too. Those are two different things that need to be studied in history. The reformers are amazing. Their writings and things, if you can get your hands on some of that, and especially the artwork that came out of that era and how much truth about the history that was told, even through the artwork. And those are two different times of history that really need to be looked at closely because it's not brought out in the churches either. Well, I think we're up. Our time is drawing to a close here. We're going to play the closing clip of the closing clip of Roger Miller, and give you 30 seconds to give your closing comment, Mike.
Well, Terry, you know, I don't know how to get people to understand that if this Constitution was designed to protect freedom and liberty, why don't we have any? So obviously something was wrong. If the Constitution was a car, it'd be in a junkyard somewhere because it sure wouldn't be out here running the highways, to draw an analogy. So, hey, I really appreciate everyone who came on tonight and who listened, other than the two obvious morons who decided to speak on whatever grounds they thought was necessary. So I hope some of the greater folks out there will chime in from time to time.
I just hope I wasn't
next
one of
them. No, I don't think that's a problem, buddy. One of the things I'll always remember, Terry, is you catch the most flack when you're right over the target.
That's absolutely correct, and that's what I was thinking a while ago. We must be being heard by somebody that doesn't like what we're the truth we're handling here. Well, Mike, have a good night, and to our listeners, thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next Thursday night on Handling the Truth. Good night, all.
Good night.
Well, you soul-selling, no-good sons of a shoe-fitting fire starter. Ought to tell you no-good preambulatory bone frame and nail it to your government walls. All of you, you dadgum government, you sorry rascal fratches. You got yourself an itch and you're wanting me to scratch it. Well, you dadgum, dadgum, dadgum government. Uh-huh. Oh, don't you know? Oh, don't you love me sometimes? Hey, boy. Of a shoe-fitting fire starter. Ought to tell you no good preambulatory bone frame and nail it to your government walls. All of you, you...
You dadgum government, you sorry so-and-so's. You got your damn hands in every pocket of my clothes.